Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Good morning, Rabbit.
Good morning, good morning, good morning. And good morning to all you out there in the world. We're glad you joined us this morning, and we have another fascinating program with some real experts. A real expert on one-pot meals, a real expert on making cheese, a real expert on quinoa, and real experts on gluten-free. Boy, you'd be so loaded with expertise by the end of today's program, you won't know where to start.
You told me we were doing a sound check.
Oh, yeah. We are doing a sound check.
So this is not the real program?
Yeah, that might as well be the real program.
We're nothing but adaptable.
We were doing a sound check, but it sounded like it was all right. So that's what we've got for you today. So.
Well, if this is the real thing, I need to add something.
Oh, you do? Go ahead then.
Our first guest, you have to include his middle initial. It's Clifford A. Wright.
Yes.
He'll explain that if you don't do the A, you get something weird.
Well, you get somebody different. You don't get who you expect.
No. Anyhow.
Are we going to get on with this program?
Yes. When this man says, and we've come to view him as a trustworthy guest, expert, whatever, when he says one pot wonders, he's talking about one pot, no little side excursions or anything. Let him tell us about it. Clifford A., right? And that A is very important, isn't it, Clifford?
It is. If you don't get the A, you'll get an antique dealer in London or a criminal in Georgia, who knows what.
Well, anyhow, you've come out with yet another cookbook, another wonderful cookbook. How many do you have?
This is my 14th cookbook.
Jeez.
Well, great. I'm glad your count and mine are the same. I counted the ones inside the book, and I got 13, so this makes 14.
This makes 14.
And that's just amazing. How do you have the energy to do all this?
That's a very good question, and the answer is one day at a time, almost kind of approach it like an alcoholic. You just need to kind of keep doing it and not worry about the end of the tunnel.
Now, there was I thinking that what you were going to say next was that what you need is good nourishment.
That you get. That's kind of part of the deal.
If you don't have good nourishment, then you can't produce all these books.
And it's not just the books, you know. I mean, he writes for gourmet
magazines. No, I understand. I understand that.
He does consulting for the Culinary Institute of America, Harvard University. He established a cooking school. I mean, just... You're a busy guy, Clifford.
Yeah, I'm a busy guy.
You missed the whole point. The nutritious food is what makes the whole thing Clifford A. Wright work.
Okay, that's a segue.
And they're all in this book. Or at least it seems like they are. There are at least 30 or 40 beef braises in there. Goodness knows what else isn't in there.
Well, we've gone this far along, and we haven't even mentioned the name of the book, which I was going to get there.
You can't always just say, this is the title of the book, and here's what's in it, and there's this many pages. I mean, you have to take a different approach sometimes. Okay. And this is called One Pot Wonders. Or is it One Pot Wonders?
No, it's One Pot Wonders.
One Pot Wonders.
One Pot Wonders.
And Clifford's going to explain to us why this is unique. And it's absolutely accurate that it's only one pot. There's no hedging on that. And also, what constitutes his definition of pot? Go.
Well, the first thing is it's called One Pot Wonders because you literally use only one cooking vessel. So it's not just about using your pot, like a stew pot or a soup pot. Any cooking vessel where all the food gets cooked, the protein, the carbohydrate, the vegetables. So it could be a stew pot, or it could be a cast iron skillet, or it could be a roasting pan, or it could be a wok, or it could be a grill, or just a saute pan, or a casserole. So in all those cases, all the food is cooked in only one vessel. So I call it One Pot Wonders because one vessel wonders doesn't sound very sexy. So
now let me just put in a clarification here. I think if I'm right, and if not, then please correct me, because when I'm cooking, for example, chili or something like that, and I've browned the meat first, then I will take it aside, I will take it out and set it on one side and then return it to the pot. That kind of placement doesn't count, right?
Well, that does count. As long as you're only using one pot, yeah. It doesn't matter how many times you put in the food and take it out, as long as you're not using two. That's the key to the whole book, is that two things are not... So often you'll see in many one-pot type of cookbooks where you need to sauté something first, or maybe you need to hard-boil an egg, or maybe you need to do something, and then it goes into a pot and it finishes in one pot. In this book, everything happens in one pot from beginning to end. And in fact, and very often, you can take that pot or that skillet or that roasting pan or that casserole and place it right on the dining room table and serve from it.
And not only that, if it's going to be really good, you cook it the day before and you put it in the refrigerator in the pot and get it out to come to room temperature before you warm it up.
There's many dishes that you can do that with in this book. Not all, but a good many of them, especially stews and casseroles.
Now, every culture, just about, I imagine every culture, period, has dishes like this, right?
Just about. The only culture that I think does not, no. I was going to say Chinese, but that's not true. Everything happens in a wok. So, yeah, I think pretty much so.
And
partly, there's a very simple reason for that, and that is most people who cook for families are interested in the economy of time and of cleanup, and this fits the bill.
Yes, the dishwashers are very happy with this.
They are, and so is the guy who's cleaning the pot at the end of the meal, which for many years was my youngest son. He liked the writing of this book.
Uh-huh. Now, there's something else that you say is an advantage to this kind of cooking, and that's that you then have the ability to layer flavors. Explain that to us.
Sure. Since everything is happening in one vessel, especially things that get baked or that get simmered on stovetop in a casserole, you're layering different foods, and almost the way you layer a lasagna, for instance. Well, anything can be layered, and once it's layered, it cooks slowly, and all those flavors meld together to create something that's a whole that's greater than its parts, just as would happen in lasagna, for instance.
But now, sometimes if you're adding things late in the cooking process, I feel compelled to sort of stir them in. Now, maybe I'm doing the wrong thing.
Not at all. It depends on the dish itself. Very often, stews will get something added later. For instance, something that doesn't cook as long as the meat, if you're making a meat.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what I meant, sure.
Right, and that's perfectly legitimate. Or if you're cooking something in a wok, let's say, and there you are tossing and stir-frying, and at the very end something has to go in, then that's okay, too. It's stews that basically you can kind of get away with the stirring or the not stirring.
Now, you have some hip ingredients, not new but recently loved, such as quinoa. I'd like your concept to start with about salads for dinner and soups for dinner.
Yeah, one of the things I like about salads for dinner is I found myself actually eating a lot of those during the summer when I either didn't feel like cooking and or just wanted something light. And the nice thing about a salad is that you can make them huge, especially if they're, and of course they are, mostly based on vegetables. And you almost can't eat too many vegetables. So it's a kind of a great dinner idea, especially when you don't want the kitchen heated up in the summertime.
Now, some of these recipes just jump out at me. Now, are they adapted from other recipes, or are they your new creation?
It's a combination of both. Some are completely new that came about just from my own kitchen and my own thinking, and others are traditional, where you would find in certain cultures. And I would say that, so for instance, if you're looking at a pot of a typical classic French stew known as the pot-au-feu, that's obviously something that's several hundred years old. But if you're looking, or a Polish hunter's stew, for instance, those are traditional dishes. But if you're looking at a chicken with a queso fundido, that's kind of a new, innovative dish that was made up using poblano chilies and Monterey Jack cheese. And so I would say they're probably evenly divided between the two.
What about this one? This Korean braised short ribs kimchi sandwiches with wasabi mayonnaise. That's a startler.
It is a definitely made-up dish. And yeah, I remember exactly when and why I came up with that, because we have something here in Los Angeles that's very popular, which are these food trucks, kind of itinerant trucks that go around selling foods. And there's this one truck that sells this kind of Mexican-Korean fusion. And I remember getting something from them. It wasn't this. It was something else. I said, gosh, this is a great idea. So I kind of went in that direction.
That launched the whole food truck.
Yeah, very much so.
Other favorite one in this book that I'm reading about is lamb and almond stew. Tell us about that.
Oh, that is actually a Spanish dish, and it probably has a pretty old history in the sense that it's the almonds and the lamb combination. Almost sounds like it's an Arab dish, and it very well may be rooted in the kind of cooking that happened in Spain when Spain was ruled by the Arabs for some 500 years.
Oh, sure, that wouldn't make sense, wouldn't it? That kind of transfer. Yeah. We noticed you had estofado, which is one of Anne's great favorite recipes. She hasn't made it for me recently. I was reminded that she needs to do that. Pass that along to
you. The rabbit.
You have goulash in there. Goulash is very mysterious, I guess. You had a special note about what can and can't be included in goulash.
Yeah, which actually comes from this wonderful book called, I think it's called The Cuisine of Hungary, which is written by George Lang, who's a famous restaurateur in New York. And he wrote probably the definitive book on Hungarian cuisine. And he gives you a real sense of what goulash is. It's fun, and it's a fun book to read, and also makes for wonderful eating.
Have you noticed the proliferation of Polish cookbooks recently?
I've noticed one or two, but I wouldn't quite call it a proliferation. But
well, I have three now.
Oh, well, then there must be something's happening, I guess.
Probably weren't any for 100 years before.
I would imagine not.
So three would be quite proliferating.
Yeah, I guess you say that's a good way of looking at it.
So tell us about garbure.
That is a famous and quite old French dish that comes from the southwestern portion of France. And it's there's a kind of family of stews in France. Pot-au-feu is one of them. The garbure is another one. And in this particular case, it's being cooked with typical ingredients from southwest France, like smoked bacon with goose fat and ham hocks and leeks and carrots and pork sausages and turnips. And it goes on, cabbage in it and potatoes and white beans. And it's very flavorful, very delicious, and it cooks for a long time until it kind of, everything just melts together in this heavenly mess of delicious flavors.
Now I love sausages. Now Anne does not like sausages. She's a school of thought that says there are two things you shouldn't watch being made: sausages and laws. But I just think that they're a wonderful product to cook with, and you do too.
I do too. I guess you noticed that.
I sure did.
I could almost most of the sausage recipes are in the pork chapter, but I probably should have just had a separate chapter called sausages. I'm sausage crazy. I go nuts over sausages, and there's a bunch there, kind of like Spanish sausages with chickpeas and with Napa cabbage and kielbasa with cabbage and horseradish sauce. But two of my favorite is what I call a greens platter with sausage, which is really a southern Italian dish that I had something like it in Naples once. It consists of broccoli rabe, mustard green, and Swiss chard, and spinach. And then with the sausage that's removed from its casing, cooked and crumbled on top of it all. And it's a wonderful dish. And then another dish which I like a lot, which is cooked in a cast iron skillet. Sounds unusual, but it's out of this world, which is pan-roasted sausages and potatoes with green grape.
That is odd.
It's odd, and once you begin eating it, you go, oh, my goodness, how did I never think of this before?
I might be tempted to try that when it's so odd-sounding. Yeah.
I would say go for it. It's a
Robert,
magnificent dish.
Can you go
dish.
For it?
Now, did you make that one up?
That is made up, yep.
You're an amazing fellow, Clifford Wright. I have to say that.
Thank you.
Nothing if not inventive. Now, what are you for dinner tonight? Are you creating a new recipe?
Oh, no, that's so funny you should ask, because I've been recipe testing like crazy all week, and I just decided I didn't want to do any recipe tests tonight. I was going to do the simplest thing I could dream up. So I bought myself a steak, and I have one big russet potato that I'm going to cut up and fry in some olive oil, and that's it.
Well, here's an accompaniment. Let me try this accompaniment on you, because I made a steak last night, and Anne said, now, why are you frying onions to go along with that? And I said, well, first of all, they're not just fried onions. They're onions that are being being fried in black walnut oil. And when they're mostly done, I'm going to transfer them into the pan in which I cooked the steak, to pick up all the steak juices, and then at the last minute I'm going to add some balsamic vinegar. And she said, you know what, that tastes really good.
You know what, I think it does. You may have just changed my dinner plans.
Well, I thought I'd just mention it, because it would certainly go with the potatoes as well.
It would, and I love the idea of onion and walnut oil. Boy, does that sound good.
Yeah, walnut, black walnut oil.
Well, the secret is to pick up the fat component that's melted out of the steak as well. I mean, you can't waste a thing.
No, you can't. That sounds like a wonderful... I think you've just done it. You've just changed my little plan for tonight.
And I've probably given you a thought for another book, huh?
It has. Of course, now you've just given me some more work, because now I've got to cut up that onion. I was going to try to keep it simple, but I guess not.
Well, Clifford, you said you were recipe testing. Is this your next book?
Yes, I'm actually... I've got a very big book that I'm working on, which is a sequel to my James Beard award-winning book, A Mediterranean Feast. And this book is on provincial Italian cuisine. And I work on that pretty much every day. And then I also have a book proposal out to a couple of publishers, and that kind of just stays on hold until I hear from them, and then I'll probably begin writing those too. But I always recipe test, even if I'm not writing a book.
Well, have a wonderful time this evening and with your nice simple meal. I hope my suggestion will help it be even more special, and we will welcome you to the program again, I'm sure, in a year or so when you have something new to add to the culinary library that we have and that everyone else should have. One Pot Wonder certainly ought to be one of those. The only problem is going to be having enough evenings to be able to make all the recipes. So many of them.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
And we'll be back with more for your pleasure right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. If you're like everybody else in the world, you're busily out there making cheese.
Oh, sure. But this is a great, even though I have absolutely no intention of ever making cheese in my whole life, this is an absolutely, totally fascinating book, told by someone who became a real expert, but told through the eyes of experts in making different kinds of cheese.
Yeah, we're going to be talking to Sasha Davies and David Blackman, and they're here in this book to tell you why you're doing everything and to hold your hand through the process. I might be moved to making cheese. I don't know, Robin.
But even if you're not listeners, this is a fascinating resource book and some fascinating insights for you just in this interview that will let you know more about your favorite cheese product.
Sasha Davies and with David Blackman, they produced a book whose time is perfectly ripe. I don't mean that like with cheese, but that's what the subject is. It's called The Cheesemaker's Apprentice, an insider's guide to the art and craft of homemade artisan cheese taught by the masters. And what a masterful piece of work this is, guys. Could you explain, like, all that you include in here? There's a long list of what everybody who wants to make cheese should know.
Absolutely. I can take that one, and David, you can chime in if I miss something. The goal with the book was to provide a foundation for someone who would be interested in either actually making cheese or learning about how cheeses are made. So the book includes interviews with members of the industry who are veterans of the industry, and they range from people who specialize in food safety and research to people who've been making cheese for generations to those who manage cheeses through the ripening process, also called affinage. And then we even have an interview with a couple people who focus mostly on selling cheese to the public, so a cheesemonger and also a fairly well-known fromager is what you would call them, similar to a sommelier in a restaurant. So we wanted to provide some perspectives from those individuals on the cheese industry and any tips they would have for home cheesemakers. And then we also offer a selection of recipes for cheeses in a range of degrees of difficulty, I guess I would say. And David, maybe you can say a bit more about that, as you definitely shaped the list of recipes or the selection of recipes that we offered.
Yeah, before you leave, though, Sasha, you yourself are also a cheesemonger, a restaurateur, and a cheese instructor, right?
That's correct, yes.
And David, you are obsessed with homemade cheese.
I call myself an obsessed home cheesemaker, that's right. My wife took me to a cheesemaking class at a local farm here, and I got hooked and decided I wanted to write about the subject and learn all about it, teach other people how to do it. And I was lucky, and I was feel very fortunate that Sasha asked me to contribute by writing the recipes for the book.
Now you're both in Oregon somewhere, right?
That's correct.
So that's an awfully good place to make milk and make cheese.
We have a lot of great cheesemakers here. Yeah. They've sprung up. It started 10 years ago or about. And it's just been all kinds of great small producers here, and one of our best producers that's been around for a long time is the Rogue Creamery.
I was just going to ask you about that. We've interviewed them.
Yeah, the interesting thing about them is that these guys who knew, I think, almost nothing about cheese decided to make a go of the Rogue Creamery after the original founder was getting old or ill or both. Yeah. I can't remember which it was.
He just recently died, which was a shame.
Yeah, Igavella. Yeah, they ended up taking the creamery over from him. He still made cheese up till the end, but they've made a fantastic product that's world class.
Yeah, I thought it was so funny when we talked to them. They said we just decided we'd enter our cheese in the London Cheese Show, and we were so surprised when we won a gold medal.
Yeah.
I thought that was pretty remarkable. What I thought we would do is, because you really can't do justice to the apprenticeship that you have in these pages. All I think we can say, listeners, is this is step by step with pictures, so that unless you can't read or unless you can't see, you're probably likely going to have success, because your picture is going to look like this next, and then this next, and then this next. What I thought instead we would do is to mine into some of the individuals involved in cheese, in this industry, as you call it, and find out a little bit about what they can tell us today about what the world of cheese is like. So I picked a few interesting characters that I thought worked. We won't go into how cheese was discovered, because apparently everybody but me knows that. and I didn't realize that. What? But the first character that I liked was the character who decided to make sheep's cheese. So you have a recipe for Tomé, and I thought his story was kind of interesting, because it was a new departure for him.
Yes, that would be Liam Callahan from Bellwether Farms.
Right.
You got it.
I even know what a bellwether is.
You also said you think we tasted some of his cheese, but I'm not sure we have. But he's Petaluma, California. Tell us a little bit about his story. He was really pioneering, I guess.
Yes, well, I think that definitely raising sheep in that area of the country was in steady decline, if it ever had a heyday prior to that. And basically, he and his mother have a wonderfully serendipitous sort of accidental cheesemaker story. His parents, he grew up in San Francisco proper, and his parents decided when they retired that they'd like to move out to the country. Petaluma is not far from San Francisco. It's without terrible traffic. You probably could be there in about 30, 35 minutes. And it's a landscape of beautiful rolling hills. They grow wonderful grass out there. There's a rich tradition of dairying, just that's mostly been focused on cows. And so when they bought this land out there and moved to the country to have this kind of bucolic existence, Liam and his brother were already off at college, and when they would come home, they would comment on how tall the grass was getting on their land to their parents. And it got a little bit overwhelmingly sort of out of control, and eventually someone suggested to his mother that she should get some sheep, because they could just keep the pastures in check, basically. And so that's how they got their first group of animals. And originally, I believe that his mother had a close friend who had kind of advised, you know, the smartest thing that you could do actually would be to sell lamb, to raise sheep for meat, and try to sell some of your grass-fed meats to chefs in San Francisco. And I think that they investigated that a bit, but that just didn't have the same appeal to them as another idea, which was to try to make some dairy products. And so many of the stories that Liam shared with me are those sort of unbelievable, hilarious tales of people who have no idea how to farm. One of my favorites was chasing sheep around and trying to catch them. And one of the most effective ways that they found to do that was with these giant fishing nets, basically. So he commented that he kind of has no idea what their neighbors must have thought of them at the time, these city slickers that move up there that are now chasing sheep around on their property with giant nets trying to herd them did eventually find great success, not without a tremendous amount of hard work and tenacity, but they took a couple trips to Europe, primarily in Italy, and visited sheep milk cheesemakers there and came up with some basic recipes that they could try to implement back in their creamery.
Let's move on to an entirely different kind of character, an entirely different kind of cheese, because if sheep's making was new to the last person we were talking about, the making of cheddar cheese in the wonderful region of Cheddar in Somerset, which we passed through twice, incidentally, just within the last few weeks, is, if you like, quite the opposite of recent invention, and simply reinvention by Jamie Montgomery and his family, who are taking the making of cheddar, I think most people would say, absolutely to new heights.
Absolutely. Was there anything specific that you were curious about James Montgomery? There's a lot to say.
I just thought it was fascinating, the level of understanding that he shows and that you show in reporting about him as to what's involved in making stirred curd cheddar. I mean, it sounds like people have been doing it for so long, you must be able to do it in a factory. But there is a lot more to it than that in order to make a cheddar cheese that's really good.
One of my absolute favorite things that he said in the interview was something to the effect of cheddar as a cheese was very unfortunate.
Huh?
You know, it was unlucky enough to be a cheese made within an empire forming governance and a cheese that everybody began to try to emulate, basically. And I think his expertise has come, again, someone who's really applied himself and has done so in some ways out of necessity to try to, part of his job is inherently to try to educate people about how his cheese is different from the cheddar that you see literally in every supermarket around the world. So his ability to articulate the processes that they use and why they use them and how their product is different is a necessity in many ways. It's part of his job to educate people about that so that he continues to have a market for these exceptional traditional cheddars.
Yeah, the interesting thing is we interviewed Max McCalman from Artisans, sweetheart, in New York.
Artisanal
in New York. He wrote a book about, I guess it was like the world's 100 best cheeses or something like that.
Right.
And Montgomery cheddar is number 2.
Right.
So it gives you an idea that in terms of someone who's a real cheese aficionado, Jamie's obviously doing a really good job. And if you want to know more about why you should value his cheddar so much, you've got to read those pages in the book. Now, here's an even more startling story. Joe Schneider is an American, but he was invited by Randolph Hutchison, the founder of the wonderful Neal's Yard Cheese Company, recruited in 2004 in order to restore something the production of which had stopped. I didn't even realize that, which is raw milk blue cheese Stilton. Now, here's a fascinating story. Perhaps you can just tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, one of the wonderful things about Joe is he really is an individual who I think enjoys the audacity of being an American who's working to bring back such an iconically English you know, traditional cheese. And I know that the decision by Randolph Hodgson from Neal's Yard to pursue making a raw milk Stilton was not one that was taken lightly. He did work with some of the existing Stilton producers. I believe it may have even been Colston Bassett, and requested that they would make an unpasteurized Stilton just for Neal's Yard Dairy. And I believe they do that for a bit of time, and then ultimately they decided it wasn't something that they wanted to continue. So Stilton, the name itself, is protected, and one of the, by definition, today, Stilton, to be called Stilton, must be made with pasteurized milk, which is why the cheese that Randolph and Joe Schneider have worked so hard to develop is called Stitchelton. So it's a close cousin and an ode to the name, but they are not allowed to call it Stilton.
I'm sorry we missed it. We were just in England for 10 days, and I'm sorry. We did have Colston Bassett Stilton
yep.
a few times, but I sure would have liked to try this other thing. Now, at concluding our interview, I picked one person out, but he's representative of really two groups of people that you mentioned. I'm talking about Matteo Keller, the co-owner of Jasper Hill, but he talks about affinage. Affinage is more than just aging cheese. And you have later chapters where people also talk about storing and serving cheese. Can you give us a couple of highlights about those two areas?
Absolutely. It's picked all of my favorite people in the industry. Not all of them, but many of them. Many of my heroes to interview. So I feel like I could speak quite a bit about all of them. But what I would say about Mateo and his brother Andy, who are running the cellars at Jasper Hill, they are truly visionaries in our industry, particularly in the United States. They've really done some groundbreaking projects. And the cellars, where they age not only their own cheeses from Jasper Hill Farm, but they also are aging cheeses from other producers nearby to their farm, they are really taking out one of the X factors in cheese production, and David, I'm sure, could speak to this for the home cheesemaker, that cheating is not finished once you pop a cheese out of the form that you've made it in. It's only beginning. So the aging process is an area where there's not a lot of expertise and support for cheesemakers here in the United States, and Mateo and his brother definitely realized that and decided they wanted to try to learn as much as they could about that part of cheesemaking and offer that knowledge as a service to cheesemakers to help them bring great cheeses and well-aged cheeses to market more easily.
Well, this brings up a subject that David has addressed, that if it is possible to make cheese at home. This is true. The easiest cheeses you can make are fresh cheeses, and you have simple recipes for making those. It is not always easy to age cheeses at home or to make aged cheeses at home, correct?
It's the hardest part of making cheese is aging it, because it takes a lot of maintenance. You need to keep checking on it. But when people say, I didn't think you could make cheese at home, well, you can, and it's, fresh cheeses are the easiest, and that's the first thing we have in our book and how I recommend people start, and it's delicious. And once you get hooked, then try making aged cheese.
And this book is going to enable you to do that, right?
It will. It'll get you on your way. And there are lots of other resources on the internet and my website, joyofcheesemaking.com.
That's a good thing to connect with.
Well, I tell you, David, I have absolutely no intention of starting to make cheese, but I think this book, nevertheless, is absolutely fascinating.
Oh, I may make some fresh cheese.
Well, you can make some if you like.
I recommend it. And once you start making, once you even start making cheese, just learn a little bit about how it's made, I think you enjoy it a lot more. And you don't need to try and make this aged cheese, try and tackle that to get something out of the book and to enjoy cheese more and appreciate those who do make it well.
Well, you know.
What an amazing task they do.
I have to restrain Peter from making salumi in our basement, and that's my last question is, I'm not sure what kind of microbes or microorganisms that I want, and I don't know what's down there, and I don't know how you control what picks up.
Some people would say you just accept what's there, and that becomes part of your product, of what you're making.
All right.
Well, here's a story, David and Sasha. I think Peter and Anne both thought they knew quite a lot about cheese, and as through reading your book and talking to you today, we realized how little we knew, but the good thing is that we have a resource available to us that we can study to our heart's content. And listeners, if you're into cheese, whether you intend to make it or not, if you enjoy eating it, you'll find all kinds of wonderful information that will help you enjoy just doing that in this book called The Cheesemaker's Apprentice. So David and Sasha, thank you so much for joining us, and I'm sure we'll talk again in the future.
Oh, thank you so much for having us.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, welcome back, and also welcome back to another hot grain called quinoa. And once you know how to pronounce it, you're going to be ordering it right and left.
Yeah, the interesting thing is it's actually not a grain.
Right.
But you'll find out about that too. So whatever you wanted to know about quinoa, how to cook it, why it's good for you, all that stuff coming up right here.
Well, our next guests are in Georgia. I hate to do this, but I was going to sing Quinoa on My Mind, but I guess I better not do that.
Well, at least you made it clear that the Georgia you're referring to is in these United States. In fact, the Confederate States of America, to be precise. We could have been talking about the country of Georgia, which is a former Soviet republic.
The song is about
Georgia.
I'll spare you. Anyhow, we're talking to Jessica Harlan and Kelly Sparwasser. Did I get that right, Kelly?
Yes, indeed you did.
And you have written a book called Quinoa Cuisine, which joins but actually stands out above this great slew of quinoa books that we've been getting on a weekly basis. So clear, and it explains what people want to know about this product that is not a new product. It is certainly ancient, but it's now newly popular.
Well, the most interesting thing in the book is that we didn't even know what it was.
We thought it was
because,
a grain.
Because we thought it was a grain, and it's really nothing like that. Go ahead, explain.
That's right. It's sort of lumped in with grains, but technically it's a seed, and it's related to beets and spinach and chard. But because it's cooked and consumed similar to grains, it is sort of lumped in. It's considered a pseudo-grain.
Pseudo-grain, yes.
It's also a super grain.
It is a super grain.
Quinoa is one of the most nutritious things you can eat.
Yeah, tell us why that is. I know I hear it all the time, but I'm not sure quite why.
Yeah, I think that the most striking thing about quinoa is that it's a complete protein, and there are very few other plant foods that are a complete protein, which means it provides all the essential amino acids. But it also has calcium and iron and fiber and potassium and B vitamins and vitamin E, and it's just sort of a complete package, especially for people who don't eat a lot of meat or who are vegetarians. It makes a really nice alternative to get protein to your diet without consuming animal proteins.
And you note in the book that, in fact, it's kind of secret stuff. Wasn't it the Incas?
Is that what you said?
Well, yeah, it's secret. It was almost sort of sacred secret stuff.
Yeah, it has a really interesting history because it was raised by the Incans centuries and centuries ago, and they considered it almost like they had religious ceremonies involving it even because it was so important to their culture. And then when the Spaniards started conquering that part of the world, conqueror Pizarro actually made it illegal to grow quinoa because he was trying to make the people more reliant on Spanish government. So it very nearly became extinct or became just sort of something that was available in the wild.
Well, we're lucky that it didn't go totally extinct. It
very
went wild. But it's primarily grown in Bolivia, right, and Peru?
Yes, mostly, although you're seeing some Canadian and American farmers trying their hand at quinoa, too. And the nice thing about quinoa is that it's grown in places where not a lot of other stuff grows, like in the mountains, in very sort of extreme climates. It's a super hardy plant, so it can be grown at high altitudes and in rocky terrain where there's not a lot of water.
And that, if we get more of it, that means the price should come down somewhat. Right now it's pretty pricey, huh?
It can. I mean, Kelly and I certainly bought quinoa pretty much anywhere you could possibly buy quinoa, so it really runs the gamut. Kelly, wouldn't you say like the cheapest we found it was at a warehouse club like Costco or in bulk?
Yeah, that was definitely the case. The one nice thing, though, is that especially with the white quinoa, it increases in volume by 3 times.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Increases by twice the amount of volume, and so it actually ends up bringing that price per serving down a little bit once you realize how much it actually increases.
Now, you mentioned something which leads us into something else. You mentioned white quinoa, but there are other kinds as well.
There are. The three most popular kinds of quinoa here in the United States are the white, which is the most neutral. There's a red quinoa, which kind of has a nice nutty flavor to it. And a black quinoa, which is the most seed-like of the three. And that one really lends itself well to Asian-style cooking and those flavors as well. It kind of has a little bit of a tea-like flavor to it. And then in addition to those three types of quinoa, you can also find quinoa flour and quinoa flakes out on the market.
Now, what's this tri-color quinoa? Is that, you mix it yourself or what?
You can mix it yourself or some, usually in the bulk bins of varying grocery stores, they'll have it pre-mixed for for you, and it's just the red, white, and black combined together. But you can certainly mix it yourself and kind of put in whatever proportion you would like of those different kinds. And it just is a nice, wonderful, colorful way to use quinoa and incorporate a little bit of each of those flavor profiles.
And it's a good way to use up the odds and ends, like if you end up with like a half cup quinoa left in your bag and it's not quite enough to make a whole meal out of, you can just mix it with other types of quinoa.
I don't know, you were looking at something in the book and I don't know what
you're
trying
to. I thought you wanted to do this. I thought it was very useful because, eating is so complicated anymore. You have these little icons to identify all manner of things about your recipes, like the clock, stopwatch, I guess it is, for 30 minutes or less, freezes well, gluten-free. Oh, and it's actually gluten-free, basically, isn't it?
Totally gluten-free.
Quinoa itself, yes, because it's not part of the wheat family, it doesn't contain gluten. So that's one of the other reasons it's become such a popular food item, is because people who are gluten intolerant or who have celiac disease can use quinoa flour in place of wheat flour in certain recipes. However, some of the recipes that we have in our book, like we don't claim to be a gluten-free cookbook. That wasn't our intention. But some of the recipes did end up being naturally gluten-free, so we just made sure to indicate that for people who are interested in that.
Now, here's a fundamental question. Your book's called Quinoa Cuisine. Clever, isn't it, to have a C word and then a Q word that sounds the same right next to it? But when you were putting the book together, did you try to write a book capitalized on the unique aspects of quinoa, or did you say, no, let me put quinoa into a recipe that I ordinarily would be making with a different grain, or maybe it's both?
I think some of the approach that we took in doing the cookbook was we really wanted to create something that allowed people who weren't familiar with quinoa to incorporate it into recipes that were already familiar to them. So in that standpoint, there are some recipes where it is used as a substitute for something that you may use rice or bulgur or another grain in. That said, we also wanted it to be a cookbook that could grow with people and people who are already familiar with quinoa could use as a reference and create recipes that really just took the different qualities of the different types of quinoa and played on those to create just really great recipes.
Now, these are your 12 basic recipes that you start out with. Conquer these recipes. You can then go on to build more recipes using quinoa?
Yeah, the essential recipes chapter, we wanted to have just some of the most straightforward recipes that you could create with quinoa that you could then adjust and vary by adding your own ingredients or making substitutions. So, like, one of my favorite recipes in that chapter is the quinoa porridge, where you prepare quinoa instead of oatmeal. And there's so many, just like with oatmeal, there's so many neat things that you can stir into it to make it a really delicious, interesting dish.
Now, how do you make pizza dough with quinoa?
You want to tackle that one, Callie? I think that's your recipe.
It's really pretty simple. You make it like any other pizza dough, only we substituted in some of the quinoa flour in conjunction with the regular flour. And it's one thing that you can kind of take note in for other baking recipes is it's a great substitute where you can just substitute half of AP flour for quinoa flour. And one thing to note, though, is it can be a little bit more dense when baking with it. But it worked really, really well with the pizza dough. And I would encourage people to definitely try it in a variety of recipes.
Yeah, one thing to note about quinoa flour, it doesn't rise like wheat flour because it doesn't have any gluten in it. Gluten's what sort of strengthens a dough to give it leavening power. So that's one of the reasons that in a lot of our baked good recipes, we only substituted part of the flour for the quinoa flour to keep it airy, like Kelly said, because it can get really dense, but also just to allow it to leaven. Like, we have a great pound cake. It's a lemon pound cake recipe that really takes advantage of the flavor of quinoa flour, which has sort of like a nutty flavor with almost like a hint of grassiness or a little bit of bitterness, and we thought that went really nicely with lemon. And we also have a chocolate zucchini bread that also really complements the flavor of the sort of interesting flavor of the flour.
Okay, so what you're saying is quinoa, in fact, does really have sort of, has a taste of its own, unlike, I would say, rice. I mean, rice doesn't taste like anything.
It tastes like
what you add to it.
Red rice, Italian red rice, and black rice have a nutty flavor.
Right,
like
that's true. So quinoa is in and of itself has interest in the flavor.
It's Yeah, I mean, like Kelly said earlier, the white quinoa is definitely the most neutral in flavor, and when you do add other ingredients to it, it does sort of, the flavor gets a little more hidden. Certainly the red and the black quinoa have a little more of a pronounced fur. But the flour, we did notice in certain recipes, like the first time we tried the carrot cake recipe, it turned out terrible. It's just like really bitter. And so we had to play around with like adding something sweet and something to offset that flavor. I felt like the flour was definitely had the most noticeable flavor. Because you're used to all-purpose flour, which, like you said, doesn't taste like anything.
Well, I bet you had a lot of recipe testing to do with this as an ingredient. You're both experienced food writers and chefs, but it really is a little tricky to work with quinoa, isn't it?
It can be when you first start out, but once you really get the feel for it, it's kind of like cooking rice, where when you're cooking quinoa, it's the same proportions. It's two part water or liquid. You can use stock or broth to one part the quinoa. And then you just simply bring those two ingredients to a boil and lower the heat down, cover it, and with the white quinoa, it simply cooks in 10 to 12 minutes.
That's
turn it off, let it
sit
for 5 minutes, and fluff it with a fork. To note, the red and black do take a little bit longer. They're about 18 to 20 minutes apiece, but it's kind of like getting the feel for rice. Once you have it, it's one of the most simple things you can possibly cook and takes hardly any time at all.
And you said you can actually cook it in a rice cooker.
You can, indeed.
It's amazing. That's terrific.
It's really easy.
Well, and your recipes cover, you have 150 recipes, and you cover all the main meal segments from starters to salads, whatever. And then you have in your appendix special occasion menus, such as New Year's Day brunch, Valentine's Day. I like the summer potluck block party, because these could the quinoa dishes can be pretty portable, right?
Absolutely.
Portable? Yeah. We had a lot of casseroles and stews and stuff that's easily visible.
We really wanted the recipes to be ones that people would go to time and time again and that they would become their family favorites over time.
Well, you did it. Again, it's quinoa, which is spelled Q-U-I-N-O-A, cuisine by Jessica Harlan and Kelly Sparwasser. And I wish you a great deal of luck with this book.
Well, thank you so much.
Thanks for having us on the show.
Yes, we really appreciate it.
And we'll be back all gluten-free after the break, so stay with us until that segment coming right up.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And if quinoa is the cereal, shall we say, of the day, gluten-free is how to cook with great variety and great interest and great flavor without having to rely on the good old staple wheat products containing gluten, which a lot of people find they are allergic to or react badly to.
Now, we get a parade of books on gluten-free. I mean, like probably 5-6 a week, I would think. And
this one's the Bible.
Yeah, we culled through them and decided that if you really want all the info and a good push to that kind of a lifestyle, this is the one you need to have, the complete guide to naturally gluten-free foods. And I think that's important.
So. And the important thing, too, before we put people off from the fact that it's free of something, one of the things that was most interesting about the author, she said she didn't cook gluten-free. She cooked tasty things that just didn't happen to contain gluten, which is a different point of view altogether. So it's not something that you can't have. It's other things you can have instead, which are just as good, if not better.
Go, Olivia Dupin.
Amidst the tsunami of books that we get across our desk about gluten-free cookbooks and recipes and lifestyles, we now have the definitive book that anyone who has an issue with gluten can access, and it's called The Complete Guide to Naturally Gluten-Free Foods, and it certainly is. And you're to be congratulated for writing it, Olivia Dupin. And Olivia brings something extra to this, several extra things. One, she herself was diagnosed with celiac disease, and secondly, she is a CIA-trained chef. Now, you can't get much better than that. Welcome, Olivia.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Now, just a short history. I was impressed with the fact that you announced you were going to be a chef at age 8.
Yeah. Well, I started out, as a kid you get bored and playing outside wasn't that appealing to me. And the thing about cooking for me was that at the end of it, you had something really delicious to eat. So that became my favorite activity to do. So I started cooking when I was 8, and shortly after that, I was watching a program, and they said that the CIA was the best culinary school in the country. So I said, that's where I'm going to go. And right after high school, that's what I did. I went, and I graduated in 2003 with a bachelor's degree from there, and it was an absolute dream come true.
And you had your dream jobs as a personal chef in New York City, right?
Yeah, I work as a private chef. I work for all sorts of different families, different situations, different health issues. But it wasn't until I was well into my career already and working as a private chef that I found out that I had celiac disease. So that sort of put...
That would have been a startler, right?
It did. It threw me, and it made me panic a little bit. I said, how am I going to continue working with my clients as a private chef without them noticing, like, that something's wrong? Because I couldn't cook with gluten anymore, because as a chef, you have to taste everything you make. So what I started to do is I started to focus on ingredients that are naturally gluten-free. You can serve a beautiful risotto to your clients that's gluten-free no matter how you make it. That's a product that never contained gluten anyway. You can make polenta. You can make all sorts of any vegetable out there. And so that's how I started cooking for my clients, and that's exactly the kind of recipes that are in this book.
And
recipes that just use naturally gluten-free ingredients.
A beautiful approach, isn't it?
Now, hold on a second. Let's not name drop exactly here, but certainly in your book you disclose that, I guess, Jessica Seinfeld and her famous husband were and possibly still are a customer. And there's
they were for a while, and I actually had a chance to watch Jessica develop recipes for her cookbook at that time, and it was a fantastic learning experience for sure.
And you have a baseball player in there, too.
Oh, yes. Mark Schneider, he's the first baseman for the New York Yankees. They're an incredibly lovely family of five. And cooking for athletes, cooking gluten-free is very valuable because gluten can sort of irritate and inflame joints. And so eating gluten-free is very beneficial for athletes as well.
But that's the... I'm looking to having my knee replaced momentarily, practically. And so that was one of the things I noticed immediately. I should have done this gluten-free stuff years ago.
You don't exactly consume gluten by the truckload.
No, that's true.
let's not get our listeners confused.
Right.
We always tell them you don't eat dessert and you don't eat very much bread. So let's be straightforward and say you have a somewhat gluten-reduced diet, shall we say.
But
this is a whole lot more than a book.
Yes.
I mean, this is, and it's not a manifesto. Although some of the books we have, it's like gluten is bad for you, gluten is bad for you, gluten is bad for you. This isn't like that at all. This is called How to Live in a World Where There's a Lot of Gluten, but I Can't Have Any. What Do I Do About That?
Right. It's sort of a book that I wish that I had come across when I found out that I had celiac disease. A lot of the books, they say, oh, well, you know, the minute I stopped eating gluten, I felt so wonderful that I never craved it again. And I said, that's really not fair, because it's setting a really high standard for people, and I don't think that the average person goes without those cravings. Food is a very emotional experience for people. You feel sad, you want to console yourself with your favorite comfort food, or you feel happy, you want to celebrate, you go out for pizza with your friends, and so our lives are sort of centered around food, and memories are created around food, and when you're suddenly being told that your favorite things are no longer available, it can be really hard. And so I wanted to be very candid about that and my experience, because I thought that it would really help people cope in a really practical way.
Well, I love the good sense and the honesty about your book. You have a section on cheating where
and
realistically says, I cheated, even though I knew I cheated, and you will cheat as well, and you just have to realize that that's going on. And it's not a question of do you cheat, it's what do you do about it when you have. And I thought that was great. Plus, there's a wonderful piece of good news, almost practically in the fine print. We were laughing about this before we came on the air, that everybody's favorite hostess cake, a Twinkie. Twinkies, you won't believe. Twinkies are gluten-free.
Yeah, that's for sure. people are slapping gluten-free labels on just about anything, things that would not normally have gluten anyhow. and people are doing gluten-free to lose weight, which I think is wrong.
anyway, back over to you. I just wanted to get those observations in.
I just wanted, there's so much in this book. Let's see if Olivia could probably summarize the more important aspects of what she's covering here, like listing how you stock a pantry.
So the first half of the book is just about the conditions that might require you to go gluten-free. I do address the gluten-free for weight loss issue. I'm sort of in the same team as you, where I think that can you eat gluten-free and lose weight? Absolutely. But is it your miracle diet?
No.
So this isn't in a diet lose weight book for sure. But I talk about all the conditions that would require you to go gluten-free, the symptoms that would be associated with it, and I walk you through sort of getting diagnosed. And then the chapter after that talks about stocking a gluten-free pantry, sort of coexisting with gluten eaters, and how to avoid contamination in the kitchen.
Which is an issue. I know that.
It is. It doesn't occur to most people that you can't share a toaster. Little things like that become an issue. And there are really simple fixes, and I walk you through them. And, like, for instance, the mayonnaise jar. You can get crumbs from gluten-containing bread in the mayonnaise jar, but the really easy solution to that would just be to use a squeeze bottle of mayonnaise instead, and you've all seen those in the store.
You're so practical.
So they're really simple, easy, practical fixes for avoiding cross-contamination in the kitchen if you are still cohabitating with gluten eaters.
And, is that what you call it? Cohabiting.
it's another
way of looking at cohabiting. But this book goes way beyond the things we just described. Because of your capability as a chef, you approach the ingredient set that's gluten-free in a really skillful way. And I love the chef tips that you have sprinkled through the different recipes, where you've got alternative approaches and things to watch out for on almost every page.
And variations, potential
variations. Yeah, every recipe I tried to include some sort of tip, either a variation on how to make the recipe dairy-free or nut-free, or some sort of tip for making it easier to prepare, quicker to prepare. But the best thing I think about all the recipes in the book are that if you are living with people who do eat gluten, you can make every recipe in the book for the entire family, and no one's going to wonder, something's amok with these crab cakes. Like, something doesn't taste right. Because all the ingredients are naturally gluten-free, nothing's going to taste off to anybody in your household.
Yeah, you know, people aren't going to say, "Where's my gluten? Where's my gluten? Where's my gluten?" You took it all away
that's
from
right.
me. That's wonderful. I think that's very. I think that's quite brilliant.
So you do.
Thank you.
You do not normally say to your clients, "I'm going to cook gluten-free foods."
No, you know what? It almost becomes a non-issue because they trust that I'm cooking for them the healthiest way that I can. If they have any particular dietary restrictions or allergies, I keep that in mind with the meals I prepare. But when it comes to the gluten-free thing, I've had more clients, most of my clients, have not been exclusively gluten-free. So it's something that they just, they don't even notice because they're eating delicious whole foods that are healthy for them, and it's not something they miss at all.
Well, I think that this is an answer to a lot of questions. I had a plasterer who was just diagnosed as celiac, and he was complaining because he was buying flour from a gluten-free bake shop, and it was $12 a bag. And you point out you don't have to get all this expensive stuff to eat naturally gluten-free foods. And I think that's where this book is going to come in really helpful.
It's definitely a huge plus. Gluten-free alternatives to gluten-containing foods, bread, pasta, things like that, are like 25% more expensive than their gluten-containing counterparts. So there's this really high markup when you're going for gluten-free alternatives to gluten-containing foods. But if you're eating naturally gluten-free and you're sticking to sort of the perimeter of the supermarket where all the whole foods are and not the processed things, you're going to be able to eat naturally gluten-free very easily and for a lot less money.
But not Twinkies.
Don't go for the Twinkies. I don't recommend it.
Okay, so I see what you've done. So what your approach is really quite different than some people who are approaching the same subject by simply saying, this is a way that I can substitute things for my for things that contain gluten. You're saying there's a whole portfolio of flavors and products that you can get that are naturally, they've never been anywhere near gluten, and they taste good, and you've made great recipes so that people can showcase that.
Absolutely. And I think that, there is a place for those foods, too, especially if you've just been diagnosed and you're used to having pasta every Sunday night and you don't want to go without it. There is a place for gluten-free pasta in your life, but we shouldn't be trying to just substitute those gluten-containing foods with a gluten-free substitute. I think by focusing on the naturally gluten-free foods, you're eating healthier and you're eating just in a more sensible way. And like I said, the biggest plus, I think, is that you can cook for your whole family or your friends, and no one's going to notice the difference.
Well, that's a terrific job. You should be very proud of yourself. We're very proud of you, and we thank you for joining us today at On the Menu.
I appreciate it so much. Thank you.
Okay, ciao, Olivia. Good luck with your book.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Well, that just about wraps it for this week, and I think that look for us again.
Same time, same place next week. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.